Today's Between the Rows podcast is brought to you by our sponsor, Gowan Canada, the go-to company. Gowan's herbicide portfolio includes Avidex and Fortress, which control Group 1 and Group 2 resistant wild oats. Don't let wild oats rob your yields. Use Avidex and Fortress to stop them in their tracks. Welcome to Between the Rows, where you get to hear the stories behind the stories in Canada's leading farm publications. Today, we feature a round table on some of the issues surrounding a carbon tax and how it could affect prairie farmers. You'll hear from Mike Rain, managing editor of the Western Producer.
There's a lot of taxes being imposed right now that are new to producers, and that's causing them to say, wait a minute, this is just one more nickel and dime issue.
Bruce Burnett, Director of Markets and Weather Information at Glacier Farm Media.
Really are going to be in a situation where we're trying to actually force more carbon in than probably would not necessarily naturally be occurring under, let's say, grassland circumstances, but we're going to be spinning our wheels on a treadmill.
And Laura Rance, Glacier Farm Media's content lead.
And then you have farmers standing up and saying, this is making us really uncomfortable. As a policymaker, does that cause you to change your point of view, or do you just push forward?
All on Between the Rows, with this week's host, Darce McMillan.
Hi, and welcome to Between the Rows. We're going to be talking about carbon and agriculture today, a hot topic with legislation coming down the pike at us, and it's also a really broad topic freighted with a lot of issues. And to help us unpack all this freight, we have Mike Rain with the Western Producer with us. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Darce.
And Bruce Burnett, who farmers know from his days at the Wheat Board and G3, and who's recently joined us at Glacier Farm Media. We're very excited to have him. Hi, Bruce.
Hello.
And last but certainly not least, we have Laura Rance, who's the content lead for Glacier Farm Media. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Darce.
Now, carbon issues associated with global climate change, they've been around us for years now, but they've certainly moved up the agenda because the federal government now has a requirement that starting next year, every province is going to have to put a price on carbon, a tax on carbon. There's been a general negative reaction from agriculture about this move to a carbon tax. It might not be understandable given that farmers are stewards of the land and that climate is so important to farming. Mike, I'll start with you. Could you give us a taste for why is there this negative reaction?
Well, I think it's the unknown, Darce. We're really looking at a situation where producers are being asked to start to pay on a per ton basis, but they haven't really worked out what they're actually paying for, what changes they might make to mitigate those costs, and is this a fair tax? Are we going to accomplish anything to actually reduce the amount of carbon in the atmosphere? And they really want to have more answers than seem to be on the table right now. And across the prairies and in Ontario, we still don't have a game plan, but taxes are coming in. Alberta's got one. BC's got one. Ontario has a plan. Saskatchewan and Manitoba are yet to Saskatchewan is, you know, saying we're going to court. But I think it's a lack of information, and that's what us producers worried about it. Is this going to be a tax on farming, or is this going to be a way to meet our climate change responsibilities from the Paris Accord?
There's sort of this sense of uncertainty, as Mike says, as far as farmers are the price takers, and they really, any cost that's imposed on anyone up the food chain, both ways, they end up, you know, they have no way of passing those costs on.
And we're so much in the world market, and that it could put us at Canadian farmers at a negative, at a disadvantage to those who perhaps aren't facing this type of tax. I guess since we don't have any of the details, is there anywhere in the world that we could be looking at that maybe does have some experience in this? I believe that Australia went down this path and then perhaps a step back again. Mike, do you have any idea, any information about that?
Yeah, well, Australia did actually bring in a carbon tax. It lasted 2 years politically. They say the carbon tax probably made for government change there. But they did a lot of research. It seemed to have been pretty well thought out. I know when it comes to agriculture, there's some great work was done by University of Melbourne. They produced a calculator that is actually works. They have a dry land version that really replicates what we do in Western Canada. And it's some alarmingly large numbers when you actually sit down and run the calculator based on a Western Canadian rotation. But they looked at all facets of it, and but producers there saw they didn't get taxed on everything, but they definitely did start to see some money come off their bottom line and move into the government's hands to be able to try and work on other mitigation strategies. And really, that's what a carbon tax is, in theory, designed to be revenue neutral. And but they're not revenue neutral if you're not actually receiving anything back. So you have to look at, is there mitigation for me? You know, as a producer, does someone actually see that money move back into research that's going to help them cut that tax or grow more to try and get past that new cost? There's a lot of taxes being imposed right now that are new to producers, and that's causing them to say, "Wait a minute, this is just one more nickel and dime issue for me to deal with." And again, it's an information issue. How does that work?
Yeah, and I think there's probably farmers see that, and then they get a little bit upset that they see themselves as doing a lot of things to reduce greenhouse gases, that they've been changing their tillage practices and so on. Laura, I think farmers see themselves as part of the solution, don't they? And this taxation issue kind of sees them as the villain.
I think it is a double-edged sword. I mean, of course, the cost that agriculture could experience in this is definitely predicated on the perception that if farmers do nothing to change how they farm, that, yes, those costs are going to be imposed upon them, and that responsibility for paying the piper is going to fall onto their shoulders because, as I said, they can't pass that along. But at the same time, you are hearing a lot more talk these days about ways that farmers can improve the fertility in their soil, the inherent fertility in their soil, by storing more carbon. So carbon is very much an asset in agriculture. And similar to the whole phosphorus debate that we've seen in some areas where phosphorus is a non-renewable resource, we need it in the land, most of our soils are depleted in it, and yet if it's running off into the waterways, it becomes a contaminant. And I very much see the carbon debate as being similar to that. So there may be things that farmers can be doing, and we're hearing this in terms of cover cropping and growing some of their own nitrogen fertilizer. Pulse crops leave some nitrogen. Anything they do to reduce the amount of fertilizer that they're buying is going to reduce their cost when it comes to carbon taxing.
Yeah, definitely. I think that this change in terms of how farmers react, that's the I guess the primary reason that you would put taxes onto these types of things. So, you know, again, if an input, let's say like nitrogen fertilizer, becomes more expensive because of a tax, and there are ways to get around it by planting more nitrogen-fixing crops, those types of things are good. I think what we have to remember, though, there is the economic framework that we have to live in. And certainly, again, if other countries, jurisdictions that we compete with, don't have the same impediments, then we are going to lose, again, some of our competitive abilities in certain markets. Maybe we don't want to be competitive. I don't know. That's more a policy decision than anything else. But certainly, I think that does change the framing of the debate a bit when we toss in the economics of global agriculture and what we produce here on the prairies. We do export a good portion of our grains, and I foresee that to happen in the future as well, because we're one of the few areas on the planet that has a surplus of commodity and not as many people. So if we're going to do that, we have to keep that in mind when we're setting some of these policy objectives from things like carbon taxation, at least anyway.
But if you take the utopian, and I think it is in a utopian view that farmers can, for example, grow some of their own fertilizer or more of their own fertilizer than they are today, that's not only reducing their exposure to taxing, that's reducing their costs, and that should improve their product, their competitive advantage on world markets if they can become a lower cost exporter.
Yes, that's right. And so, but what I'm saying is other crops that perhaps aren't going to be that way or are going to suffer. And the sooner we sort of recognize that, probably the better off that we are. That, you know, we'll have to make some changes in terms of what our cropping dynamics are on the prairies in light of these taxes. But on the other hand, we've got to make sure that everyone is well aware that that is what's going to happen. Again, certain crops are probably not going to be as viable just because of the fact that we're going to be introducing a tax.
And some of those crops are the crops that producers rely on for, if you look at southern Saskatchewan, big parts of southern Alberta, that's, and they're already on a three-crop rotation, a pulse, a canola, and a cereal. And so when you find yourself doing those things, when you're using precision ag already, because I, wearing my farmer hat, I don't buy a pound of fertilizer that I don't intend on trying to get into a plant. There's always going to be losses, but we don't see a lot of, because of our short seasons, we don't see fertilizer spreading as commonly because of, there are losses, even if you're using products that restrict losses. We tend to see everything going in the ground being used as efficiently as possible just to make to be competitive. We're a long way from tidewater, so we're already battling a lot of things uphill. And for those producers who are already building their own and as much as they can, they're restricting their nitrogen down to what's just going to be used for the crop. They find this very frustrating because this means for them, it's a farmer tax. And there's the mitigation strategies are really tricky. If you have traditionally a very dry growing season, we really see the Palliser Triangle situation kick in. Again, you're not going to grow anything that isn't your target crop, and nobody's going to help you with that unless we see carbon strategies that say this is a Canadian strategy. That means that that farmers look at things like the carbon that's sequestered in a grain bin before you export it is not on the list, and I think it should be because other large emitters are not taxed on their output. If you're a fertilizer, if you're agrium producing fertilizer, again, you're not taxed on the output product. You're taxed on the energy you use. Farmers are not going to be given this, as it sits right now anyway, farmers are not going to be given credit for the carbon that's stored in the bin before it goes off to export. And some people would say, well, let the buyer pay that. But we're in a global market, so buyers tend not to pay any more than they have to, and the Black Sea is not so worried about exporting a product with a pending carbon tax on it.
You know, farmers, and I know farmers in Manitoba are so hot about this. There's talk of them forming another political party to fight this. Just what we need in Canada, another political party. But I guess the question I have, though, is how successful are they going to are they going to be able to stop this? And, you know, when you create a tax that's essentially designed to make people feel uncomfortable, and then you have farmers standing up and saying, this is making us really uncomfortable, as a policymaker, does that cause you to change your point of view, or do you just push forward? And I think that's the dilemma that the farm organizations are struggling with right now.
I know we've been looking at creating farm meetings that would deal with the carbon issue and bring players from across the globe together. And I mean, we actually did find that it's such a political issue that we actually had to push back some plans to be able to do that this spring. When we look at it, there's a lot of the players that would normally be, gung-ho to sponsor that and see some farmer eyeballs attached to these sorts of large-scale meetings are saying, yeah, but we don't know what government's going to do, and some of it might be punitive. So everybody is trying to find a foothold. I know the farmer organizations are still planning to organize meetings around this and try and get more information to the place and to create their lobbying efforts for government because, again, if you're the Sask party, you definitely want to be seen to be putting up a struggle about this, even though come the beginning of 2018, the tax is coming. It will be imposed. How we deliver that is the issue.
Yeah, and it is so weird that it is all being done on a provincial level. I mean, I guess the idea is that, first of all, maybe that some of the political heat falls off instead of on the federal government onto the provincial level. But, we were talking about how a tax could put it at a disadvantage to others in the world. You could also have differing policies that put one province at an advantage or disadvantage to the next province next door. So,
well, for example, in Manitoba, there's really not a lot of opportunity to get into carbon trading because we don't have large emitters like you would have in Alberta in terms of the soil industry. And I'm not even sure, I mean, and maybe Bruce, you have some thoughts on this in terms of, you know, with a soil science background, I mean, how realistic is it to look at the potential of putting more carbon into the soil?
Well, certainly we could be viewing the soil as a carbon sink, or another place, or in other words, a place that you store it. One of the dilemmas that I find from this debate, though, is that we're doing this to combat global warming, but obviously we are warming. The planet is warming. Our growing seasons are getting longer, and that naturally is going to reduce the amount of carbon that we have in our soil. So we really are going to be in a situation where we're trying to actually force more carbon in than probably would not necessarily naturally be occurring under, let's say, grassland circumstances, but we're going to be spinning our wheels on a treadmill by trying to sequester more carbon in a warming environment. And that does concern me because it's probably better than doing nothing in terms of the carbon balance, but we're not going to see appreciable results from it either.
I sometimes wonder, I mean, like, should we even be going down this pathway? But on the other hand, you know, governments have blunt tools at their disposal, so things like taxes and regulations and so on. Still, though, we are facing, and you know, tell me if I'm wrong here, but I think, you know, that the science is telling us that global warming or global climate change is real, that it is associated with these climate-changing gases, and that humans are the main generator of these gases. And so, you know, should we, is it really just so complex that we can't really do anything on a human scale? We just have to adapt, and maybe that's where all the effort should be put into, is adaptation to changing climate? Or do we actually try to, through our governments, to do something about this, you know, to try to slow the warming?
I still come back to the whole concept of trying to do the right thing for the right reasons. And some of the research is showing us that if you are doing things on your land, such as, I mean, we've seen some really stellar examples lately of farmers that are succeeding and profiting through intercropping, which is increasing biodiversity, but it's reducing their cost, and it's increasing their experiencing over-yielding. They're getting more yield than they're getting otherwise. Cover cropping and some of the perennial cropping that you're starting to see creep into these prairie rotations, those are not only mitigating some of the effects of carbon tax, if and when it comes to be, but it's also increasing the resiliency of that land in the wake or in the face of climate change. So on one hand, you have a mitigation strategy and an adaptation strategy going on simultaneously. I don't know at this point how realistic that is for most farmers to implement, but there are some examples where farmers are being quite successful at that.
So it could be generating at the very least, a change in thinking. And, you know, we might be as efficient, you know, thinking that we're as efficient as we can possibly be. But that's in the context of the way we've always done things. Maybe you start to think about doing things in a much different manner.
I was at a meeting last week where the keynote speaker at an organic conference was a zero-till farmer. And in 30 years of covering agriculture, I would never have expected to see that, because those two types of farming systems are at polar ends of the spectrum when it comes to their approach. But what's bringing them together is that they're both finding some advantages in terms of cover cropping. And the soil scientist that was on the agenda that day, Jill Clapperton, who many farmers have heard speak at conferences, she calls that the new conventional. That's the new conventional farming on the prairies. Is that going to happen in our lifetime? I don't know. But there are farmers that are doing it.
I think that we have opportunities to do a lot of things differently. I think for the most part, with the precision ag tools that are available to us, with potentially with autonomous and robotic systems, potentially the opportunity to manage land a little more intensively. It's not to say it's not there, but to make it a to place an extra tax on an agriculture that has to be globally competitive, and to place it universally on every piece of land, no matter whether you're in the lightest sandiest soil with the potential for severe drought, or you can't support more biology than you're really getting out of it now. Again, over time, those things come into a plane that might pull down land prices in some areas and cause other areas to show their productivity and taxation resilience through higher or lower costs. But that seems like a long way off for me right now.
Well, I think this discussion today has shown us just how complex this issue is, and everything from politics to biodiversity and the way we farm. So certainly we'll be talking about it again in the future, on a future podcast here. So thanks, everybody, for participating.
Mike Rain, Laura Rounce, and Bruce Burnett. Join us again next week for another episode of Between the Rows. I'm Darce McMillan, and thanks for listening.
We'd like to thank Gowan Canada, our sponsor for today's Between the Rows podcast. Remember, if you have Group 1 or 2 resistant wild oats on your farm, use Avidex or Fortress to control them. Between the Rows is a production of Glacier Farm Media, Canada's leading farm publisher. We'd love to hear what you think of the show and invite you to send your comments to btr@farmmedia.com, or visit us at membersgetmore.ca and sign up today.